This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. We begin this morning with a warning from forecasters. They're predicting that a tropical storm will hit Southern California tomorrow. KCAL-TV reporter Lauren Posen in Long Beach says people are getting ready for rain.
We don't know how bad it's going to be, but better to be safe than sorry.
It's an unusual sight in the dead of summer, but the threat of a tropical storm on a path toward Long Beach spurred residents into action.
You got to take precautions because this place flooded last time pretty bad. So you don't know.
Long Beach is one of a handful of coastal communities bracing for heavy rains and ocean swells from what's left of Hurricane Hillary once it makes landfall.
I live right down the street, and so obviously a little concerned with what could happen.
This is going to be another tough weekend in what was once one of the most beautiful places on Earth. Recovery efforts continue in Lahaina on the Hawaiian island of Maui, where the death toll from last week's wildfires has now reached 114. CBS's Jonathan Vigliotti is there.
The scale alone is unimaginable. We're talking 80% of the community was destroyed. We know that hundreds of FEMA agents are here on the ground. The majority of them are devoted to this search and recovery effort. They are being assisted right now by 40 cadaver dogs. This is incredibly tedious work, and it's also very emotionally taxing and tolling on all of the first responders.
A state of emergency has been declared in parts of Canada as wildfires threaten more land. CBS's Michelle Miller has that.
The city of Yellowknife in the Northwest Territories was a ghost town last night after officials ordered the entire city of 20,000 to evacuate. And hundreds of miles away, wildfires spread into the city of Kelowna in British Columbia. Officials there said this weekend could be the most difficult for the region in what's already Canada's worst wildfire season on record.
The number of COVID cases is increasing across the U.S. The CDC says hospitalizations are up 60% in the past month. CBS's Errol Barnett spoke to Dr. Bernard Kamens, the director of infection prevention at Mount Sinai Hospital.
COVID numbers are rising again. How concerned are you about that?
It's not a cause for alarm. I think it's important for us to just pay attention, especially those who are at risk for hospitalizations or deaths from COVID.
A new sentence has been ordered for a man from North Carolina who pleaded guilty to a petty offense in the January 6th Capitol riot. The federal appeals court in Washington ruled yesterday that James Little was wrongly sentenced on a misdemeanor to both prison time and probation. He pleaded guilty to a charge that carries up to 6 months behind bars. This is CBS News.
If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Civic Media Radio Stations, providing your news, conversations, and fun you won't find anywhere else.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Parts of Wisconsin are forecast to reach highs in the 90s next week. Pet owners are encouraged to keep their animal friends safe. Mike Moan reports.
Kristen Schrank of the Wisconsin-based group Alliance for Animals says in general, ripple effects from a warming planet pose threats in a variety of ways.
We're experiencing extreme heat and cold, wildfires, smoke and poor air quality. So this is not only impacting, you know, humans on the planet and their companion animals, but it's also impacting wildlife.
For summer heat, Schrank says pet owners should always keep fresh and clean water accessible along with a shady spot. For those with a yard, she says enhancing landscaping, such as adding trees or shrubs, is helpful. Cooling mats for dogs are another option. And when taking pets on a walk, experts say you should be mindful of the hot pavement and either put protective boots on the animal or have them stay along the grass. Despite greater awareness, Schrank says there are still tragic situations involving pets being left in hot vehicles or outside in the extreme heat with no protection. Last year, there were 57 heat-related deaths among these animals in the U.S. She says under Wisconsin law, there are certain civil liability protections for those who spring into action if they observe that type of situation.
Essentially, it does allow people to cause damage or, for example, break into a locked vehicle that has an animal that is suffering inside due to heat.
And the person taking action also has to follow certain guidelines, such as calling 911. Mike Moan, Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you out, because only you can prevent wildfires.
Hey, Assistant Smokey Bear, call me Papa Bear, because I'm grilling up dinner. Do you get it?
Yes, good job.
So, what should I do with all these coals?
Don't just toss them out. Put them in a metal container, because those embers can start a wildfire.
I understand. The stakes are high.
Ha, 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 ha.
Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
If I could be you.
And you could be me.
For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way.
To get inside.
Each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning once again. This is our second hour on Saturday, August 19th, 2023. This is our weekly review, our analysis, and our discussion of those most important events and stories in law and government and justice in America. We're spending most of our day today, including our first hour and now our second hour, talking about these rule of law snapshots, most of them related to prosecutions of the former defendant, Donald Trump, for violations of federal and state law coming out of Georgia just this past week. This multi-count sprawling indictment under RICO and other state charges alleging this scheme, this RICO-premised attempt to undermine the counting of votes there, the voting itself, and making all sorts of false statements, false representations, other things set forth in that indictment. And then turning back to the January 6th indictment coming out of the U.S. District Court, the U.S. Grand Jury in Washington, D.C., alleging again in four counts against the singular defendant there in Washington, D.C., his name again, Donald Trump. In the wake of all of that, that is these four different prosecutions, two of them state, two of them federal, the other federal case, of course, being the Mar-a-Lago documents case, which we've talked about in the past. In the midst of all of that, some other significant events happening just this past week, right before the break at the top of the hour, talking about the identification of Ken Chesbrough, one of the lawyers involved in putting together the scheme to overthrow the 2020 election, always identified up to now as being on the desk side, if you will, the organizing, the conspiracy side of these allegations, identified just yesterday as being on the ground with the boots, so to speak, on January 6th, walking around there in the company of Alex Jones, again, this great conspiracy perpetrator, not only with respect to many, many matters in America, but also focusing upon shootings in America and other matters that are a part of our public consumption here. Alex Jones there on the ground. Other people on the ground that day, including the people, the associates, the affiliates of a group called the Proud Boys. We've talked about them before. In addition to the Proud Boys being this nationalist anti-government group identified by the government, prosecuted successfully by the U.S. Department of Justice for seditious conspiracy, the other group also out there, Stuart Rhodes and his folks, the Oath Keepers, similarly prosecuted seditious conspiracy for the events of January 6th on the ground on that day. We know that Stuart Rhodes and others receiving significant sentences by the federal district courts in Washington, D.C. Stuart Rhodes received 18 years imprisonment. That's his term. He's on appeal right now to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. But that sentence likely to be upheld in the future. Just this past week, the Department of Justice, anticipating the much-related sentencing of the other major defendant in charge of the Proud Boys. His name is Enrique Tarrio. We have talked about him at great length in the past. Department of Justice announcing it is going to seek a prison term for Enrique Tarrio of 33 years in federal prison. 33 years in federal prison. If we come anywhere near to that, if the judge who's presiding over the case comes anywhere near to that amount, that will be the most lengthy sentence ever imposed upon any of the 1,000-plus defendants, including those on the ground, other circumstances, Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, out there to this point. And what is the reason for that? And why do I bring that up again, anticipating the sentencing of Enrique Tarrio in the near future? Why is the announcement by the Department of Justice of that huge sentence request significant? It is important because of what we've talked about at great length here on this broadcast, and that is the notion of deterrence. Yes, indeed, you want to deter Enrique Tarrio and all the others. They have been convicted. They were sentenced. They will spend significant periods of time in prison, as will the other members of the Oath Keepers, as will many of the other non-affiliated defendants, also the subject of these prosecutions coming out of Washington, D.C. The message, however, is not only about them, but to other people down the road who might think about assaulting not only a federal enclave like our capital, the place of justice, the place of representative government, the symbol of our republic, but sending the people the message that if you do this, if you engage in this kind of behavior, we'll stop you, we'll deter you from doing it, but also sending the larger message of deterrence to America that this conduct will in fact bring you into the scope of federal prosecution, and you will go away to jail for long, long periods of time. This is no small request. It is almost unprecedented in the history of the U.S. Department of Justice, and we'll see what the federal judge does in this case. But anticipating that, again, this major news coming out of Washington, D.C., that the Department of Justice is seeking this extraordinarily high penalty against Enrique Tarrio, responsible kind of as a mid-level person, not there on January 6th, actually in Baltimore, but plainly organizing people on the ground, the boots on the ground, kind of this mid-level person between the people attacking the Capitol, going in, and once again, the people who are organizing it at a higher level. And that brings us once again to the people like Ken Chesbro and John Eastman and Sidney Powell and Jeffrey Clark and Boris Epstein, again, this sixth person identified as an unindicted co-conspirator in the federal indictment in Washington, D.C. Of course, the number one unindicted co-conspirator there in that federal case, Rudy Giuliani. All of those people, with the exception of Boris Epstein, also named by name in the Georgia indictment as well, among the 19 people specifically identified in that Georgia indictment, identified by virtue of what they did in the federal indictment, alleging once again violations of the federal law in connection with the January 6th event and the attempt to overthrow our republic and undermine the counting of votes on January 6th. So let's turn to that indictment. We talked previously about principal aspects of that indictment, specifically noting some things that were set forth in the indictment presented to America in the wake of this grand jury process going on for many weeks and months in the U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. Before we get back into that, to resume our conversation of last broadcast, I want to reaffirm how this comes about, what a grand jury is, to address some of the issues that continue to be out there about not only the Georgia prosecution, which also comes out of a state grand jury, actually two of them there, but this, a federal grand jury. Who are they? Where those people come from? They are people who are pulled in just as others would be for a trial jury, a trial of a criminal case, of a civil case. They're you and me. They are not prosecutors. They are not investigators. They are bankers. They are educators. They are masons. They are healthcare providers. They are entertainers. They are all kinds of people out there who are called in to determine whether or not there's probable cause to find that an indictment, charges should be issued on particular counts. And that's what they did in both of these cases coming out of Georgia and then also in Washington, D.C., indicate as well that a similar analysis goes forward with respect to the Mar-a-Lago grand jury
They also reviewed evidence. And likewise in New York, that case involving the fraudulent documents and the attempt to undermine the 2016 election by paying off Stormy Daniels. That's still pending in New York. All of those things looked at by people who are impartial, not the prosecutors, not the investigators themselves, plainly endorsed by the prosecutors and now responsible for bringing these cases to trial, but a result of this independent review undertaken in the Federal District Court in Washington, D.C. by 26 people assigned responsibility for reviewing the evidence presented to them. Significantly, one more comment about a grand jury before we launch back into the content of the indictment itself, and that is this. The grand jury is not an agency, not an office of the U.S. Department of Justice. It is not. It is a branch, it is a subunit, if you will, of what? The United States courts. It's a different branch of government. And so when there are grand juries that are impaneled here in eastern Wisconsin and western Wisconsin and many of the other districts, all of the other federal districts in the United States of America, they are a part of the courts. They are not a part of the executive branch. They are not a part of the Department of Justice. And indeed, they're selected by judges, federal judges and federal magistrates in those particular districts that bring them together, that commission them, that give them their oath of office, that tell them that, yes, indeed, they're going to be reviewing evidence for as much as 18 months, maybe even more. This independent entity, not a part of the Department of Justice, brought in people, a community of peers, if you will, who decide whether or not charges will be brought. And that's the genesis. That's the basis for this indictment that we began to look at last time and again, reviewing once again today as we go into this process. Before we do that, we do have one caller on the line. We appreciate your calls, of course, throughout this hour and future broadcasts as well, and all of these issues. Dana, thanks for joining us this morning from La Crosse. Glad to have you with us.
Good morning, Jim. Happy Saturday to you.
Happy Saturday to you, too.
Say, I'm glad you're touching on a lot of the co-conspirators, because we know who Donald Trump is. We know his involvement. My question, with the knowledge that we do have on who the co-conspirators are that are identified already in all these different cases, like, for instance, you know, Fannie Willis, she's got the 19 indicted co-conspirators, and
yes,
then there's 30 more that aren't named.
Right.
And first question, are we going to learn who those 30 people are? Is there possible indictments coming for them? But the main crux of my question, Jim, is based on what we know, and who a lot of these people that are involved, and maybe not all have been indicated yet. I want to know, should Ron Johnson be worried legitimately? Is justice going to be coming for him eventually? The guy's as crooked as the day is long, and we need to get him.
Very good. All right. So a couple of things to unpack there, Dana. Thank you, as always, for your good questions. Yeah, let's talk about some of that. We've got these unindicted co-conspirators. What we know who they are, the six people there in the federal case. You're absolutely right. We have got about almost 30 unnamed, unindicted co-conspirators, in addition to the 19 in Georgia. Right after this break, I'm going to take up those two questions and talk more about intent, talk more about the possibility of future indictments, not only in the federal system, the state system, and take up your very good questions about who those 30 people are and who other defendants might be out there, arguably including members of the United States Congress. Stay with us for answers to those very good questions from our great caller this morning.
Does your financial strategy include your hopes and dreams? What matters most to you? For over 100 years, Thrivent has helped clients like you find financial solutions for life's important goals. Explore a full range of options, from financial advice and investments to insurance, banking, and generosity programs. To have a heart-to-heart about your finances, contact Mandy Roberts, who you may recognize as Mandy Wright. Call her at 715-470-1303. 715-470-1303. Mandy Roberts proudly serves the Central Wisconsin area. For more details, visit thrivent.com/disclosure.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here. I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunny and warm with a high near 92, heat index approaching 99. For tonight, mostly clear, lows around 70 degrees, a little smoke in the air, and some smoke early on your Sunday, then mostly sunny, 86. For Monday, mostly sunny, 85. Currently, 75 degrees.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
We are back here in Morning Cannolis, responding to a terrific set of questions offered by Dana just before the break, indicating in particular he's got some interest, as you all do, as I do as well, in what's going to happen to unindicted co-conspirators, named co-conspirators, other people who might be involved in these schemes, charged now as a RICO violation in Georgia under state law, but again charged in the federal district court in Washington, D.C. under a number of different charges, including conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracies related to the obstruction of voting certification, that, of course, the counting of votes by the Speaker of the House of Representatives and the Vice President, and significantly, conspiracy to violate the civil rights of Americans, that is, your right to a proper and fair and decent election where your votes are indeed counted. And so Dana asking a lot about, we're going to find out who some of these other unindicted co-conspirators are. We know them coming out of the Georgia indictment because many of them, again, affiliated with people identified with the 19. Highly likely, as this case goes to trial, whenever it goes to trial, that as evidence of those particular events set forth in great detail in that indictment coming out of Georgia, that there will be evidence in court about who they are. A lot of what happens right now is that discovery is produced, information is produced to the defendants in the Georgia case, also in the federal case, including the former president. And in all of that, with great clarity, the names and identities and the involvement of those unnamed, unindicted co-conspirators is there. And so defendants can see it. Their attorneys can see it. That's part of our process. That's what we should be doing, in fact, whenever we engage in these criminal prosecutions. Presumption of innocence attends all defendants, and they get a right. They get a right to know the charges against them and the kinds of things that are going to be presented at trial. So defendants are told, and again, highly likely that during the course of a trial, could also be during the course of pretrial proceedings with respect to a motion to dismiss, a motion to suppress. Some of that information can come out in the public domain, but generally not released until some public proceeding, some judicial proceeding in which those things are publicly disclosed. And so the other good question coming out of our last caller, also asking about other people out there, including members of Congress, arguably our own senior senator here in the state of Wisconsin. What about their exposure? What kinds of things might still be possible out there? And the answer, of course, is we know well that Jack Smith, the special counsel, indicted in this very narrow but compelling indictment one defendant, and his name is Donald Trump. He identified, obviously, six others, but the text of that overall indictment, which we're going to get into in a little bit greater detail,
coming up shortly. The text of that also indicates an awful lot of other people involved in this process. And the narrow answer to your question is, of course, the decision about charging other people within the discretion of what? A grand jury, once again, presented with evidence of involvement. Grand juries look not only to the people who actually did the events that are the subject of the substantive counts in indictment, but you can also look at people who aided and abetted, called Section 2 culpability, people who supported this in some way, who provided some mechanisms, and of course, thinking specifically about people in Congress, arguably our senior senator, who may have done things likewise to promote what happened on January 6th, maybe even before and after. All of that presented to a grand jury, highly likely that the names of many people in Congress are on folders, whether they're electronic or paper folders, in Maine Justice, who are being looked at for their involvement, and you make determinations, make recommendations, certainly the grand jury, about whether or not the evidence is compelling enough. The grand jury, again, determines whether there's probable cause to believe that someone that's in Congress or someplace else was responsible in some supportive way for doing something that supported this overall initiative to try to overthrow our election, and determining then if down the road the government can produce evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that that person did indeed aid and abet, support, or was somehow involved directly in a conspiracy, an agreement to overthrow. And those are the questions. Those are the kinds of things that grand juries will take a look at and determine whether people will be indicted well beyond those folks indicted to date. Strong anticipation that Jack Smith, not only while this case against Donald Trump federally is pending, will indict the others we had identified as unindicted co-conspirators, and probably people even beyond those specifically identified in that grand jury indictment. So great questions, great thoughts. Appreciate those comments and the callers always. The broad answer, of course, is what is this allegation? What are the four counts in the indictment all about? Purpose of the conspiracy, to overturn the legitimate results of the 2020 presidential election by using knowingly false claims of election fraud to obstruct the federal government function by which those results are collected, counted, and certified. We talked about that the last time, and in particular, talked about the ways in which the defendant, Donald Trump, he's a singular defendant. Unlike the indictment in Georgia, which is broad, alleging in very, very broad and sweeping terms many, many aspects of this, the federal indictment, again, telling this very compelling story, but identifying to this point only one defendant, Donald Trump. And one of the questions, of course, comes out of this is, what did he believe? What did he honestly know? Did he understand, as it sets forth in this indictment, that the claims he was making about the 2020 election were false and fraudulent, and that he knew they were false? And that's a principal aspect of this indictment. It speaks to us from virtually every page of this indictment. The establishment of what's called scienter, mens rea, understanding that what you're doing is for a criminal purpose. Donald Trump probably going to maintain during the course of his trial, whenever that happens, Jack Smith wants it to start in early January. Unlikely that date will stick. But nonetheless, whenever it happens down the road, one of the things that's required to the government to show is that Donald Trump not only did these kinds of things, but he did them for a corrupt motive, corrupt intent. When we come back after this break, we're going to talk about some of the information in the indictment. Again, charges, not convicted statements here, but charges against him that suggest very strongly that he knew what he was doing was wrong, that he had this intent, and that Jack Smith will be able to present this to a trial jury, just as he did to a grand jury, and get a conviction for the knowing and purposeful, intentional attempt to overthrow our election. Stay with us for that discussion right after this break.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
CBS News Brief. Preparations are underway from California to Mexico as people brace for the arrival of Hurricane Hillary. Robbie Berg is at the National Hurricane Center.
There can be some gusty winds. It's not going to be at hurricane strength by the time it reaches California, but it does appear that the rainfall is going to be the biggest issue.
Hawaii's Governor Josh Green is promising to rebuild in the wake of those deadly wildfires, even as the search for other victims continues.
There are now 470 search and rescue workers and 40 search dogs combing through the hundreds of burned buildings. And they've already completed searching more than 60% of the disaster area.
This as a state of emergency is in effect in the Canadian province of British Columbia due to wildfires. This man lives there but has chosen not to leave his home.
Well, the smoke has been insane, hazardous. It's like Beijing air quality going on.
He says it's been tough to breathe for a week. CBS News Brief. I'm Allison Keyes.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
For 105.7 WCFW, I'm James Kelly. Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers will lead a trade mission to Europe next month, his first since before the COVID-19 pandemic. Governor Evers, Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation Secretary Missy Hughes, and 10 companies will be on the mission, to include stops in Brussels, Amsterdam, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg. The governor also plans to stop at a green energy park and a hub for water technology. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources is encouraging new and experienced hunters to enroll in a hunter education course before the upcoming fall season. Courses are available across the state and in a variety of formats, including a traditional in-person course, an online course with a field day, and an online-only course for hunters over the age of 18. As part of the program, hunter education graduates receive a certificate accepted in every U.S. state, Canada, and Mexico. I'm James Kelly. You're listening to 105.7 WCFW.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different, but you probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Don't let biased algorithms, or degree screens, or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
The RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight.
The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
It's never personal, only politics. The Devil's Advocates Radio Show with Dom and Crute.
Weekdays from 4 until 6
on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
This is 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.
And we are back this morning. Thank you for once again joining me as we continue to talk about this major indictment, this federal indictment of a number of weeks ago, a 45-page indictment returned by a federal grand jury in Washington, D.C., a part of the court system, alleging in four different counts that Donald Trump conspired to defraud the United States of America, obstruct the voting certification proceedings, and conspired to violate our civil rights in connection with the January 6th events and things both before and after that. One of the principal focuses of the indictment, again, this federal indictment, still pending, coming up for a trial at some some point in our nation's future was that the defendant, Donald Trump, knew, in fact, that the things he was saying out there were false. And why is that important to establish? It's important because in order to create and to establish for members of the trial jury a clear understanding and enable them to embrace the notion that Donald Trump knew that he was doing this for a corrupt intent, got to be able to establish that he knew his claims were false. The things he was saying out there in the public domain were unsupported by anything that he was hearing, anything that could be justify his purported defense that he truly understood that the election had been stolen. No basis for doing that. And in fact, the reason for the charges against him, the basis for it, the theory is that he's saying all these things not to preserve the legitimacy of our government, the future of the republic, as he sometimes hints, but rather simply to stay in power. And that's why these intent statements, that's why all this about scienter and what he knew, what he understands at the time and still understands to this day, are so important. In the indictment, again, the claims he's making are false. He knew they were false, and he acted corruptly to accomplish this thing that would undermine our republic. In fact, the indictment goes on to say he was notified repeatedly that his claims were untrue, often by the people on whom he relied for candid advice on important matters and who were best positioned to know the facts. Again, that coming from the indictment specifically. Let me identify some of those to underscore this all-important issue about what he knew, what he understood, and the fact that any defense premised upon his belief somehow that he didn't get it, that he truly believed that the 2020 election had gone in his favor, that the election had in fact been stolen from him, was simply unsupported and not true, and indeed that he knew that to be the case. He knew he was lying to America. Why? Because of all these things set forth in this indictment. Among them, defendant's vice president, we know his name, obviously Mike Pence, personally stood to gain by remaining in office as a part of Donald Trump's ticket, and whom the president asked to study fraud allegations, told Donald Trump that he had seen no evidence of an outcome determinative fraud. In other words, nothing in Mike Pence's view, his examination of this, suggested anything other than that the Trump-Pence ticket had lost. And he said that to the president. Senior leaders of the Justice Department, again, a very important part of this indictment, appointed by Donald Trump and responsible for investigating credible allegations of these election crimes, told Donald Trump on multiple occasions that various allegations he was making of fraud were completely unsupported. Once again, telling him directly, the director of national intelligence disabused the former president of the notion that the intelligence community's findings regarding foreign intelligence would change the outcome of the election. Nothing about the intelligence supported that as well. Department of Homeland Security, their cybersecurity and infrastructure security agency called CISA, likewise, indicating there was no support whatsoever that the 2020 election had been stolen. It was, in fact, the most secure election in history, according to CISA, and they told Donald Trump exactly that. Days later, according to the indictment, after the CISA director, whom, again, Donald Trump had appointed, this is Donald Trump's own person, announced publicly that election security experts were in agreement with him, that claims of computer-based election fraud were unsubstantiated, and based upon that, Donald Trump fired him. That's what the allegations in the complaint are all about. Senior White House attorneys, likewise, telling the defendant, disabusing him completely of this view that he had won the election, selected by him to serve as his aides and his assistants, informed Donald Trump no evidence of an outcome determinative election fraud, told him that his presidency would end on Inauguration Day in 2020. All of these clear signals to the president and establishing once again that he knew what the truth was. And there was nothing about anything in his own mind that would indicate that indeed he had won the election and therefore his efforts to overturn these purportedly false reports and false results of the Electoral College were justified in any way. Senior staffers on the defense 2020 election campaign, according to the indictment, likewise, sole mission was to ensure his reelection, told Donald Trump on November 7th, 2020, that he had only a 5 to 10% chance of prevailing in the election. Success was contingent on the Donald Trump winning ongoing vote counts or litigation where? In Arizona, Georgia, and yes, Wisconsin. And within a week of that assessment, Donald Trump, of course, lost in Arizona, lost in Wisconsin, meaning that he had lost the election. He knew that as well. State legislators and officials, again, many of those in Donald Trump's political sphere, if you will, voted for him, wanted him to be reelected, repeatedly told Donald Trump that his claims of fraud in their states were completely unsubstantiated, false, and resisted his pressure to act based upon those. And, of course, the indictment also identifies these many state courts, federal courts, the neutral arbiters, the indictment says, responsible for ensuring the fair and even-handed administration of election laws, rejected every outcome-determinative post-election lawsuit filed by Donald Trump, his co-conspirators, in this federal indictment, and his allies, providing Donald Trump with real-time notice that his allegations were meritless, further supporting this notion that there was no basis to go out there and state, as he repeatedly did, that the election had been stolen from him and that in these various states, the fraud was continuing. Again, why is that significant? It goes to this issue of intent, showing that the defendants, Donald Trump's purpose was not to ensure the republic, not to ensure the integrity of the process, but simply to remain in power, knowing that he had no basis whatsoever to do so. All of that coming from the knowledge piece, the intent piece in this indictment, going to loom large in the presentation of this case in front of the trial jury. The other issue, of course, which we talked about last week, was this sort of related defense we're seeing, a First Amendment violation, saying that he had the right to go out there and advocate and say these things about the 2020 election. Of course, as we talked last week, paragraph 3 of the indictment, right up front, addresses this issue. The grand jury says, you know what, Donald Trump, you got a right to say those things. You've got a right to go out there and maintain that you did, in fact, win the election. That's your First Amendment right. You don't have the right. What you don't have the right to do is commit crimes. You don't have the right to commit violations of the civil rights laws, to obstruct the certification of voting, to defraud the United States. And you did all that, again, with the intent to undermine the election. That's what this indictment is about. And that's why the First Amendment allegation, the First Amendment position, if you will, that he was somehow simply vindicating his First Amendment rights is completely meritless and will also fail in the trial of this case, as will any attempt to show that Donald Trump truly believed that he'd won the election, just the opposite. The indictment speaks loudly and clearly on every page of its text, and it continues to be, of course, the focus of the continuing prosecution by Jack Smith and others in his office. We've got another caller on the line. Mark, appreciate your comment, your question this morning as we continue our march through the indictments, not only in Georgia, but also now in the U.S. District Court in the District of Columbia. Mark, your comment or question.
Yeah, I was hearing all the comments, especially appreciate Dana's comment from La Crosse. But it occurs to me that all these people that were involved in this were all in violation of their oath of office. They're not taking an oath to do certain things according to the law. They're, and of course they are by implication, but they're supposed to be protecting and defending and adhering to the constitutions of the United States and of the various state constitutions. And my preposition or supposition would be that anybody who knew that this was going on at state or federal level had a duty under their oath of office to the constitutions to sing out about this right now. And I mean that you have Robin Voss, who actually was promoting to stroke Donald Trump's ego, spending how many millions of dollars is it now under for Michael Gableman to conduct his fraud investigation. Of course, there wasn't any. This has been proven time and time again. And I think that we need to know what they knew and when they knew it. And because if you even heard something about this was going on, it was your duty as a constitutional officer to actually report it and to sing out about it and condemn it. And there's too many of them that have not condemned it.
Absolutely.
They have not condemned it. And perhaps I'm making a stretch here, but maybe that's just one man's opinion. I think I'm right, because you take an oath to the Constitution,
right.
You're elected officer, you take an oath to the Constitution, and they've all violated it.
Right. No
Robin Voss and Fitzgerald and the whole bunch.
Right. No stretch at all, Mark. No stretch at all. And in fact, it also is the implicit and explicit understanding of the indictment coming out of Georgia. If you read through all of that, we're going to spend some time next broadcast going through it in greater detail. Certainly as we right now in the middle of the federal indictment alleging the 2020 election fraud issues here, you get the same sense that these are people, again, the unindicted co-conspirators and others who are in these positions of responsibility. Let me comment on that. I think that's an incredibly important point to make, Mark, and I appreciate the call. Oath of office, absolutely. Who are the people who are surrounding the president, these people who are telling the president, as I just said, about his loss, but also, as you indicated, a larger obligation to come forward and say, you know what, I'm seeing some things here. I'm witnessing things that are indeed in violation of federal law, state law, or simply wrong, contrary to our Constitution. They had an obligation and do have a continuing obligation to come forward. We know some of them did. We see some of them in the testimony, the transcripts of the House Select Committee last year, and the report that was ultimately published. Some very bold, and I wouldn't say brave. They're doing their jobs, but brave in the context of a nation in which you get threatened for coming forward and testifying about these things. Brave in that sense, coming forward and doing exactly, Mark, what you said they've got to do. You took an oath of office, whether you are an elected official, the President of the United States of America, the Vice President. We'll get to this as well. He did take an oath of office, too. Turns out that Mike Pence is one of those people who did push back. And there's a major section of this indictment talking about all of the conversations that he had with the former president, pushing back on that, and perhaps not going forward and doing what you're asking him, that I would have asked him to do as well, to come forward and describe these things that he is seeing in real time, but certainly taking the stand that he is not going to go down the road that the former president is going down to try to overturn the election, saying he's got no constitutional right to do that. Obviously, in the end, we're continuing with that position on January 6th and beyond. There's another way. There's another way in which all these people took an oath of office, and in ways big and small, in ways that are charged, in ways that probably will still be charged down the road, and that is the oath of office as lawyers, too. It is significant that of those 19 co-conspirators, those 19 co-defendants in Georgia, many of them are lawyers. We're going to talk about that in greater detail next broadcast. But look at the cast of characters, even in this federal indictment. It's Rudy Giuliani. It's John Eastman. It's Sidney Powell. It's Jeffrey Clark. It's Ken Chesbrough. Those five unindicted co-conspirators, what brings them together? Well, there is a conspiracy, yes, to undermine what should have been and was, in the end, the proper counting of electoral votes that put Joe Biden in office. But they're also lawyers. In addition to being right around the president, and they're providing political advice, strategic advice, which they can do, but they're also lawyers who are obliged to come forward in the courts and in other venues to tell the truth. Rudy Giuliani and Jeffrey Clark strike me as especially problematic. Jeffrey Clark, during the course of the Trump administration, a high-level leader of the Department of Justice, responsible for the oversight of a lot of civil litigation, environmental litigation there. Rudy Giuliani, a former U.S. attorney, also a part of the Federal Department of Justice in his past. Hugely troubling that all of these lawyers also give up on their oath. And indeed, many entities around the country, including California, New York, going after them for their licenses. And we'll talk about that as well down the road. Oaths of office to the people of America, an oath of office to their jurisdictions as lawyers. When we come back, we're going to talk more about those kinds of things and other matters set forth in the indictment against Donald Trump in the federal district court. Stay with us for that final segment coming up in just a few minutes.
Radio.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station.
Tired of hearing only one side of the story? Do you want news and information from people who, like you, know what it's like to work hard every day and still struggle to make ends meet? Then tune in to The Rick Smith Show every weeknight from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on the Civic Media Radio Network. Be part of the conversation. Tune in, turn on, and take back the American dream. The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Bry.
And apparently, Maggie Dawn, Big Newton lover of the Maggie Dawn Show.
I was so offended, Jane. You know how much I love and admire you. You're like my freaking radio hero. And then to hear you bash my Newton.
It's still bad.
You want the cakey part cakey. You want the jammy part jammy. That is like bringing me back.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, sunny and warm with a high near 92, heat index approaching 99. For tonight, mostly clear, lows around 70 degrees, a little smoke in the air, and some smoke early on your Sunday, then mostly sunny, 86. For Monday, mostly sunny, 85.
It's 76 at our studios.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
We are back here for our final segment this morning, talking about the federal grand jury indictment against Donald Trump pending in the federal district court in Washington, D.C., and spending some time parsing through the specific allegations, anticipating some defenses by the defendant, Donald Trump, explaining how it is that those defenses will almost certainly fail, and underscoring ultimately the point that I make, which is this is a compelling prosecution. Understanding, once again, the defendant presumed innocent until proven guilty, until a jury unanimously comes back and finds him such. But assuming that Jack Smith, as he will present all of this evidence before that trial jury, a compelling case, a hugely compelling case in this speaking indictment. That's why we're spending so much time going through it. Concern that I've had in the recent weeks about this general notion of not appreciating the nuts and bolts of the allegations themselves. It's easy when you read headlines, easy when you look at the media generally that does not have the prerogative, the time even that the civic media affords me to go through this in great detail, to think, well, gee, maybe there's not a whole lot there. There is. And that's the reason why we're spending all this time talking about the specific things in this indictment that established the defendant's, Donald Trump's, intent in doing what he did, that shut down his First Amendment claims that he was simply speaking out loud and therefore he should be exonerated, and otherwise supporting this notion that he did indeed engage in this conspiracy with others to undermine who we are in America. The indictment says specifically, the defendant's knowing false statements were integral to the criminal plan that he had to defeat the federal government function. That's strong language. It's right there, returned by a grand jury to obstruct the certification and interfere with others' rights to vote. That's citizens of the United States of America, and to have their votes counted. It goes on to talk about the ways in which, in particular, those kinds of things were effectuated. Indeed, there are specific references, pages and pages, of accounts by which the defendant, Donald Trump, and these six unindicted co-conspirators, and probably others, reached into states like Arizona, like Georgia, which we're going to talk about again in great detail next Saturday as well, like Michigan, like Pennsylvania and, yes, indeed, Wisconsin. The accounts of the ways in which they attempt to perpetrate their scheme in terms of reaching into the states and then also coming back to Washington, D.C., involving the Department of Justice in an attempt to overthrow the election, attempting to involve the vice president himself in doing the same thing, attempting to involve a group of false electors here in the state of Wisconsin and in other places around the country in accomplishing this multi-purpose scheme to undermine our democracy. In our last few moments, I think it's significant, given the fact that we're here in the state of Wisconsin to talk about and recite out loud specifically the ways in which Donald Trump and these others in our state attempted to undermine the election results here. Page 20, a significant section about Wisconsin. November 29th, 2020, a recount in Wisconsin that Donald Trump's campaign had petitioned for, paid for, did not change the election result. In fact, it increased the defendants, Donald Trump's, margin of defeat. And so, according to the indictment, we know this from facts as well, Wisconsin Supreme Court rejected an election challenge by the campaign, noting that nothing in this case casts any legitimate doubt that the people of Wisconsin lawfully chose Vice President Biden and Senator Harris to be the next leaders of our great country. That's in the indictment, okay? That's a finding by the grand jury. Then, on December 21, as a result of that Supreme Court decision, the Wisconsin governor, who had signed a certificate of ascertainment on November 30th, identifying Biden's electors as the state's legitimate electors, signed a significant certificate of final determination in which he, the governor, recognized that the state Supreme Court had resolved this controversy regarding the appointment of Biden's electors. And he confirmed, that is the governor, that Biden had received the highest number of votes in the state and that his electors were the state's legitimate electors. That's set forth in the federal indictment coming out of events here in Wisconsin and underscoring the legitimacy of the electors properly identified to represent us, the voters at the Electoral College. Paragraph 50. That same day, in response to the court decision that had prompted the Wisconsin governor to sign that certificate of final determination, Donald Trump did this. He issued a tweet repeating his knowingly false claim of election fraud and demanding that the Wisconsin legislature overturn the election results that had led to the ascertainment of Biden's electors as the legitimate electors. On the same day, that's what the defendant, Donald Trump, does. That's what's in the indictment, the federal indictment here. December 27th, Donald Trump has a discussion. And he has a discussion with two people. The acting attorney general, his name we know is Jeffrey Rosen. This is after the previous attorneys general in the case, Bill Barr, Jeff Sessions before him. And the deputy attorney general, the acting deputy attorney general, his name is Richard Donahue. And at that time, the defendant, Donald Trump, raised with them, those two, Rosen and Donahue, a specific fraud claim that there have been more votes than voters in Wisconsin. Okay? That's what the former president said to the attorney general and the deputy attorney general. And the acting deputy attorney general, with respect to Wisconsin, informed Donald Trump that claim that he was making was affirmatively false, simply not true. And that, going back to the previous caller's comment, those are people inside the general government here that show, in fact, that you've got people coming forward and telling the defendant, Donald Trump, that what he believes, or what at least he says he believes, is simply not true. And again, on January 6th, the same date of the insurrection, the defendant, Donald Trump, publicly repeated knowingly false claims that there had been tens of thousands of unlawful votes in the state of Wisconsin. That's what it says in the grand jury indictment against Donald Trump. This federal indictment goes on to talk about this plan that capitalized on ideas presented by the defendants, by the unindicted co-conspirators, including co-conspirator number 5. Co-conspirator number 5, again, we've talked about already. His name is Chesbrough, Kenneth Chesbrough, this individual, again, charged by name in the grand jury indictment coming out of Georgia, and an unindicted co-conspirator. And he, in particular, according to the federal indictment, was an attorney who was assisting Donald Trump's campaign with legal efforts related to a recount in Wisconsin. Once again, Wisconsin looming large in this indictment. that memorandum, again, that the co-conspirator, number five, Kenneth Chesbro, evolved over time from a legal strategy that initially was going to preserve Donald Trump's rights to a corrupt plan to subvert the federal government function by stopping Biden electors' votes from being counted, and then evolved into other ways as well of pursuing all of this. When we return next Saturday, we're going to talk more about the false electors scheme, about these memorandums, one of them called the Wisconsin Memo. We're going to talk more about Jeffrey Rosen and Richard Donahue, their engagements with the former president. I'm going to talk about false electors as well, including among our discussion, the vice president himself. And then we're going to return to the grand jury indictment in Georgia and talk in the same way with great detail about the specifics there, the premises, the predicates by which the grand jury there made the findings of probable cause that the defendant had engaged in these criminal acts. All of this a part of our continuing exposition of these charges against the defendant. Join us next week once again here on Morning Cannolis for that very important discussion. Thank you for joining me this morning as well.
Civic Media isn't just another broadcast company.
We're your neighbors. We bleed green and gold.
And we love nothing more than to help fellow Wisconsinites succeed.
Whether your business wants to advertise to your local community or the entire state, Civic Media can help. Find out more at civicmedia.us.
The Devil's Advocates Radio.
The entire light beer industry is under attack from the right at this time. Apparently, that they no longer have women in bikinis selling the beer.
I would suggest, and this is on the Fox Entertainment Network.
I believe it's the Fox News. Well,
well, I just hope I don't get into Captain Morgan and Diet Cokes, man. That'd be a sad day.
The Devil's Advocates Radio with Dom and Kroot. Weekdays 4 till 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.